The Birth of Tragedy by Friedrich Nietzsche. An audio summary narrated for the AIIO Book Library. This was his first book, published in 1872, when he was 27 and holding a chair in classical philology at Basel. He had been appointed at 24 without having finished a doctorate, which tells you how promising he seemed. This book ended that promise. The classicists rejected it. A brilliant young rival published a pamphlet demolishing it, and Nietzsche's students deserted him. He never recovered his standing in the discipline. The full title in the first edition was The Birth of Tragedy Out of the Spirit of Music. It asks an academic question, why Greek tragedy arose and why it died, and answers it with a theory of art, a theory of existence, and a piece of advocacy for Richard Wagner, who was at that point the most important person in Nietzsche's life. 14 years later, Nietzsche republished it with a new preface called An Attempt at a Self-Criticism, and it is one of the most brutal things any author has written about his own work. He calls it badly written, ponderous, embarrassing, image-mad, and image-confused. He says it should have sung rather than spoken. He is ashamed of the Wagner material and of what he calls the corruption of a Greek problem by modern German hopes. But he does not disown the core. What he keeps is the pair of terms the book gave the world and the question underneath them, which he says he still considers the real one. What does it mean when a people that is healthy, strong, and blessed needs tragedy? Why did the Greeks at their strongest require the spectacle of catastrophe? The book's organizing idea is a duality named after two Greek gods, and Nietzsche's claim is that all art is generated by the tension between them. Apollo is the god of light, of prophecy, of measure, and of form. His art is sculpture, and his condition is the dream. What Apollo gives is the beautiful image, bounded, individual, luminous, comprehensible. Nietzsche attaches him to what Schopenhauer called the principle of individuation, the fact that the world appears to us as separate things with edges. The Apollonian is the impulse to make a shining, ordered surface, and to say that the surface is enough. Dionysus is the god of wine, of intoxication, of dissolution. His art is music, and his condition is not the dream, but drunkenness and ecstasy. What Dionysus gives is the collapse of the boundary between one person and another, and between the person and the world. In the Dionysian state, Nietzsche says, the individual forgets himself entirely. The slave is free, hostility falls away, and the human being feels himself to be part of something larger that does not care about him individually and does not stop. The two are not simply opposites in the sense of good and bad. They are two ways of dealing with the same underlying fact. That fact is delivered in the book's most famous piece of storytelling. King Midas hunts the wise satyr Silenus, companion of Dionysus, and demands to know what is best for human beings. Silenus laughs and refuses, and when finally forced, tells him, "The very best thing is beyond your reach, which is never to have been born, never to be nothing. And the second best thing for you is to die soon." That, Nietzsche says, is what the Greeks knew about existence, not the serene, cheerful, marble-white Greece that the 18th century had invented, a people acutely aware of the horror and absurdity of being alive. So what did they do with that knowledge? This is the argument that makes the book more than a piece of art history. Nietzsche says the Greeks did not overcome the wisdom of Silenus by philosophy, or by religion in the consoling sense, or by looking away. They overcame it by art. Specifically, they interposed a world of shining forms between themselves and the abyss, the Olympian gods. And the Olympians are not moral. They are not there to reward the good or punish the wicked. They are beautiful, powerful, capricious, and thoroughly alive. And what they do is live human life at a higher intensity, gloriously and without apology. The Greeks invented them, he argues, for one purpose, so that existence would look worth having. The gods justify human life by living it themselves. He calls this the Apollonian solution, and he is clear about what kind of solution it is. It is not a lie exactly, but it is a screen. The whole radiant Olympian order is a defense, thrown up by a people who had looked into the terror of existence and needed something to look at instead. From this comes the sentence the book is best known for, and the one Nietzsche kept in the later self-criticism. It is only as an aesthetic phenomenon that existence and the world are eternally justified. Notice how strong that claim is. Not that art makes life more pleasant. That art is the only thing that makes life defensible at all, because every other justification, moral, religious, or rational, has to make claims about the world that turn out to be false, and art does not. And the title question, where does tragedy come from? Nietzsche's answer, and this was the part that outraged the classicists, is that Greek tragedy was born out of the chorus, and that the chorus was originally a chorus of satyrs, meaning worshippers of Dionysus in a state of ecstatic identification. His reasoning is that the chorus is not, as scholars had assumed, an idealized spectator or a stand-in for the audience's moral commentary. The chorus came first, and the dramatic action came second, as a vision that the chorus sees. The satyr chorus, in its Dionysian state, has dissolved its individuality and looks out at the world, and what it beholds is the god suffering. That vision, projected into images and speech, is the stage. So tragedy, in this account, is the two gods fused. The music, the rhythm and the chorus are Dionysus, the dissolution, the truth of a world in which individuals are torn apart. The dialogue, the characters, the stage pictures and the clarity of plot are Apollo, the beautiful image that makes the truth survivable. The Greek hero, then, is not there to teach a lesson. He is there to be destroyed in front of you, in a form beautiful enough to bear. Oedipus and Prometheus, whom Nietzsche discusses at length, are individuals suffering the fate of individuality itself. And this explains the paradox that opened the book. Why does a healthy people need this? Because the Dionysian truth is going to be known one way or another, and there are only two ways to receive it. Either it destroys you, or it comes wrapped in Apollonian form, where it can be experienced as tragic pleasure rather than as annihilation. Tragedy is how the Greeks looked directly at the wisdom of Silenus and stayed on their feet. Then Nietzsche asks why tragedy died, and his answer is the most provocative thing in the book. Tragedy did not decline, it was killed, and he names the killers. The first is Euripides, the last of the three great tragedians. Nietzsche's charge is that Euripides brought the spectator onto the stage. He made the characters ordinary, gave them recognizable domestic psychology, explained the plot in a prologue so no one would be confused, and pushed the chorus to the margins where it became decorative. Everything became intelligible, and in becoming intelligible, the Dionysian element, the music, the ecstasy, the dissolution, was drained out of it. But Euripides, he says, was only the instrument. The real force behind him was Socrates, and it is Socrates the whole second half of the book is about. Nietzsche calls the new principle aesthetic Socratism and states it as a formula. To be beautiful, everything must be intelligible. Beside it, he sets the Socratic ethical claim that virtue is knowledge, that one sins only from ignorance, and that the virtuous man is the happy man. Together, these amount to an optimism, that reason reaches all the way down, that what is wrong can be understood, and that what can be understood can be fixed. Nietzsche identifies Socrates as the theoretical man, and he means the type, not just the person. The theoretical man believes that thought, following the thread of causality, can not only understand being, but correct it. He takes pleasure in the uncovering itself, and he is sustained by an unshakable faith that the depths of the world are reachable by thinking. And then Nietzsche makes his largest historical claim. Socrates is the turning point of world history, the vortex around which everything after him arranges itself. Every subsequent age has been Socratic. The whole edifice of Western science, education, and the belief in progress descends from this one conviction. And it displaced the tragic view of life so completely that the tragic view has been almost impossible to recover. He is careful to note the strangest detail about Socrates, and he does not pretend to resolve it. The dying Socrates, who conquered the fear of death by reason, and who was the model of the theoretical man, is also the man who reported a recurring dream telling him to practice music. Nietzsche wonders whether the most rational man of antiquity suspected at the end that there was something reason could not reach. The middle sections of the book turn on Nietzsche's own century, and this is where the argument becomes a diagnosis of modernity. He calls the culture that Socrates founded Alexandrian, after the scholarly encyclopedic world of Alexandria, a culture of the librarian and the researcher, whose ideal human being is the theoretical man equipped with the highest powers of knowledge and working in the service of science. Its patron saint is the optimist who believes the world can be corrected and that knowledge is a universal medicine. Nietzsche argues that this culture has a structural problem. It requires a slave class, since somebody has to do the work while the theoretical class thinks, and it simultaneously teaches a doctrine of the dignity of labor and universal rights, which makes that class impossible to sustain. He thinks Alexandrian culture is therefore self-undermining and heading for a crisis. Whatever one thinks of the argument, it is an early instance of a claim that has been made many times since. But the more interesting move is the one about the limits of knowledge. Scientific optimism, he says, works only so long as the researcher does not reach the edge of what can be known. Follow causality far enough, and it eventually curves back on itself. At that boundary, the person who took logic seriously discovers that logic bites its own tail, and the optimism collapses into something else. What is on the other side is the tragic insight, which requires art to be born. Nietzsche believed this had already begun in Germany, and credited two people. Kant for showing that the categories with which we know the world are conditions of our own knowing rather than features of things in themselves, and Schopenhauer for drawing the pessimistic consequence. He thought their work had broken scientific optimism from the inside and made a return of the tragic possible. The final third of the book argues that tragedy is being reborn in Germany out of music, and this is the part Nietzsche later found intolerable. The argument on its own terms is consistent. If tragedy was born from the spirit of music, then a musical culture of sufficient depth could give birth to it again. He believed German music from Bach through Beethoven had kept the Dionysian alive under the surface of an otherwise Socratic Europe, and that Wagner's music drama was the completion of that line. The chorus restored as the orchestra, myth restored in place of psychology, and the audience returned to the ecstatic condition rather than the critical one. He also makes a claim about myth that outlives the Wagner material. A culture without myth, he says, loses its healthy, creative, natural power, and modern man is a starving figure digging through the past for something to eat because his own age offers nothing to feed him. The abstract state, abstract education, and abstract law are what remain when a culture's myth is gone. But the Wagner sections are advocacy, and they are written by a man in the grip of a personal relationship. Nietzsche later broke with Wagner comprehensively, over Wagner's nationalism, his anti-Semitism, and his final turn to a Christian posture in Parsifal, and the break makes the closing chapters of this book painful to read against what came after. In the 1886 Self-Criticism, he says exactly this. He accuses himself of ruining a Greek problem by attaching German hopes to it, of trying to build a modern movement out of an ancient insight. And he says the book should have had the courage to be a piece of art rather than a manifesto. The preface Nietzsche added in 1886 is worth treating as part of the book, because it is where the mature writer tells you what the young one got wrong. He is savage about the style. He calls it an impossible book, badly written, clumsy, sentimental, uneven in tempo, without the will to logical cleanliness. And he says it addresses itself to the initiated rather than arguing anything. He is savage about the influences. He says he spoiled the Dionysian premonition with Schopenhauer's formulas, that he laboriously expressed strange new valuations in Kantian and Schopenhauerian language, and that these were valuations which ran fundamentally counter to the spirit and taste of both men. And he is savage about the hope. The romantic expectation of a German rebirth he calls a delusion, and he is explicit that his youthful enthusiasm attached itself to something unworthy of it. What he keeps is the question, restated more sharply than the young man had managed. Is pessimism necessarily a sign of decline? Might there be a pessimism of strength, an intellectual preference for the hard and the terrible arising out of well-being rather than out of exhaustion? Is there such a thing as being ill from overfullness? That is a genuinely new idea, and it is the seed of everything Nietzsche wrote afterwards. He is separating two things that get confused. The person who says life is terrible because he is failing, and the person who says life is terrible because he is strong enough to look at it. He thinks the Greeks were the second kind, and he thinks the difference between the two is the most important distinction in psychology. He ends the preface by scolding his own book for not being cheerful enough. and telling it to learn to laugh, which is Zarathustra speaking backwards into his own youth. The argument in summary, that art is generated by the tension between two impulses, the Apollonian of form, boundary, image and individuation, and the Dionysian of music, ecstasy and the dissolution of the individual. That the Greeks were not serene, they knew the wisdom of Silenus, that the best thing is never to have been born, and their brightness was a response to that knowledge rather than an absence of it. That the Olympian gods were an artwork built to make existence bearable, which justify human life by living it at a higher intensity, and not a moral system. That existence and the world are justified only as an aesthetic phenomenon, which is a far stronger claim than art being valuable. That tragedy was born from the Satyr chorus, and is the fusion of the two impulses, Dionysian truth delivered in Apollonian form, so that it can be experienced, rather than merely suffered. That tragedy did not fade but was killed, by Euripides in practice and by Socrates in principle. That aesthetic Socratism holds that to be beautiful, everything must be intelligible, and that behind it lies the belief that reason can reach the bottom of things and repair them. That Socrates is the turning point of history, and that every age since has been Socratic, including our own. That scientific optimism holds only until knowledge reaches its own limit, at which point logic curves back on itself and the tragic insight returns, requiring art to be born. That a culture without myth is a starving culture, living off the past because its present produces nothing to feed on. And from the later preface, that there may be a pessimism of strength, an appetite for the terrible arising from overfullness rather than from decline, which is a different thing entirely from despair. This book has been attacked for 150 years, and much of the attack lands. The scholarship is not scholarship. The book has no footnotes, no citation of sources, and no engagement with the philological debate it enters. The young classicist Ulrich von Wilamowitz Mühlendorf published a pamphlet accusing Nietzsche of ignorance and of abandoning method. And on the narrow professional question, he was largely right. Nietzsche never replied in kind, and the discipline sided with his critic. The central historical claim is unproven. That tragedy originated in a satyr chorus of Dionysian worshippers is a hypothesis, not a finding. The evidence about the origins of Greek drama is thin and ambiguous. And the reconstruction Nietzsche offers is driven by the theory rather than supporting it. The treatment of Socrates is a caricature. Socrates is compressed into a single principle, and the reading depends heavily on Plato's presentation while treating it as transparent. Many readers have also noticed that Nietzsche's Socrates is suspiciously well designed to be exactly what his theory requires. The Wagner material is propaganda, and its author said so. Roughly the last third of the book is an argument for a contemporary artistic movement, presented as the conclusion of an inquiry into antiquity. Nietzsche's own later verdict is harsher than any critic's, and the style, as he also admitted, is a genuine obstacle. It is overheated, it assumes agreement, and it substitutes rhetorical momentum for argument in exactly the places where argument was needed. What survives is nonetheless remarkable. The Apollonian and Dionysian pair entered the language and has been productive far beyond Greek drama. The account of Greek brightness as a construction over an abyss changed how classical antiquity is read. The diagnosis of a culture built on the belief that everything can be understood and corrected has only become more pointed. And the question in the self-criticism, whether an appetite for the terrible can be a sign of health, is one no other philosopher had thought to ask. On reading order, because this is the odd one out among Nietzsche's books. This is early Nietzsche at 27, still speaking through Schopenhauer's metaphysics and Wagner's cause. The voice, the vocabulary, and the loyalties are all different from the later work, and he tells you so himself in the preface he added later. If you have read the mature books, come to this one for the origins, the taste for the terrible, the suspicion of Socrates, the claim that art rather than truth is what makes life bearable, and the diagnosis of a rationalist culture are all here first, in undeveloped form. If you are starting from nothing, do not start here. On the genealogy of morals is the argument. Beyond good and evil is its companion. Thus, spoke Zarathustra, is the poetry, and best left until the ideas are familiar, and read the 1886 self-criticism first, not last. It is short, it is the best thing in the volume, and it tells you exactly which parts the author still stood behind. What makes this book last, despite everything wrong with it, is the reversal at its center. We tend to assume that a culture produces tragic art when things are going badly, and cheerful art when things are going well. Nietzsche's claim is the opposite. The Greeks produced their darkest art at their strongest moment because they were strong enough to look at what they knew. And the sunny, rational confidence that succeeded them, the belief that everything can be understood and corrected, was not an advance on that. It was a way of not looking. Whether or not the history holds up, the question does. When a culture stops being able to face catastrophe in its art and wants everything explained, resolved, and made intelligible, is that a sign of maturity or of a nerve that has gone? That was the summary of The Birth of Tragedy by Friedrich Nietzsche. This narration is an original summary and commentary, and it paraphrases rather than reproduces any translation. If it caught you, read the real thing. From the AIIIO Book Library. Thank you for listening.